We're going to call State Government Finance to order. And I think Representative Peterson, do you want to approve the minutes or move the minutes today?
So moved.
Representative Petersburg moves the March 24th minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The minutes are adopted.
Oh, you're going to be early today.
All right. We are going to start with Representative Grunhagen's bill, House File 2971. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in omnibus bill. Representative Grunhagen, welcome. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Glenn Grunhagen, and the bill I have before you deals with the concept of, I have to apologize, I'm just getting over a cold.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
We appreciate the distance from us right now.
Hopefully the Hopefully the microphone won't spread it, okay? But anyway, it has to do with dynamic analysis versus static analysis in terms of revenues, also, I have an amendment, Madam Chair, that I'd like to add the A3.
I'm going to move
the bill in the order that I'd like to have it.
Sure thing, Representative Grunig. I'm going to move the A3 amendment to put the bill in the order that the author wishes. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right. Okay, we're looking at the A3 amendment along with House File 2971. Mm. To your bill.
Okay. What the bill does then, it requires on an optional basis the Department of Revenue, and the individuals are here, they'll also speak to it, to come up with a dynamic and not just a static analysis, not only on revenues, but also on tax bills and on regulations where possible. And that's what the amendment update. It addresses all three of those areas. Again, I'd like to stress it's an optional recommendation in order to give them some flexibility and time. These type of analysis, according to the information I have, are done by several other states and also the federal government in most cases. And the difference between dynamic and static is that static, let's just say on a tax bill, it's a dollar for dollar spending expense. Under dynamic, it's if we reduce taxes, does the private sector benefit and we actually see growth in the private sector, and the result is we actually see higher tax revenues, okay? One of the ways an accountant explained dynamic versus static to me was under a static analysis, fiscal analysis, you're going to be precisely wrong. Under a dynamic analysis, you're going to be approximately right, okay? So the choice is if you want to be precisely wrong or approximately right, right? And I strongly favor a dynamic analysis. And I've given you a couple of handouts to illustrate why I came up with this bill. The first one is from MMB, dated April 2015. If you look at the last paragraph, and again, MMB is supposed to be nonpartisan. It says because the gas price dropped dramatically, this increased family spending. The average family in Minnesota saved about $900 due to a drop in the gas price. It goes on to say that this was equal to a tax cut for Minnesota families. And if you read the last sentence on that page, it says this provides a boost to state economic activity in 2015 and 2016. So the net result of that is we've had some nice surpluses. And one of the reasons we've had surpluses, according to NMMB, is because the state's economic activity has rebounded. And a major reason, or part of the reason for that, is the drop in gas prices, which gave families more disposable income. So again, here we see MMB comparing a tax cut to more money for families to higher tax revenues in our state. All right? Now, just to make sure this is bipartisan, John F. Kennedy believed in this principle, okay? And so did Ronald Reagan, right? And under both their administrations nationally, Tax revenues grew exponentially due to tax cuts. The second piece of information I'm giving you is from the Center of the American Experiment. Minnesota's on the move to lower tax states, 2016. And it shows that after we implemented a $2 billion tax increase, between 2013 and 14, Minnesota lost nearly $1 billion in net household income to other states. In other words, we raised taxes, and under a static assumption, we should just automatically get more tax revenue because people will just simply keep doing the same thing, only pay more taxes. But under a dynamic analysis, we see that human nature takes over when you raise taxes too high compared to neighboring states or other states in the union, and the result is we lost about $1 billion in taxable income. Now, just turn the page over, and you can see this has been a history in Minnesota of losing more and more income as people are moving out of the state, and of course, according to this report, one of the primary reasons is because of Minnesota's tax levy compared to other states. So if you take that $1 billion of net income, not only do we lose most of it high income, not only do we lose the state income tax on that, but we lose the other spending that they would have done in our state. So the total loss of revenue to the state of Minnesota is probably in the neighborhood of $200 to $300 million. Again, both of these analyses show that within a year or two, there's a dynamic result to our tax revenues. The other things I'm going to assume is that all of us, regardless of party background, want higher tax revenues. Now, one party might want it to grow government. The other party might want it to reduce taxes or to incentivize the private sector. But all of us would like to see higher tax revenues. So the question becomes, what's the best way to do that? And I took a decongestant and it's dried my mouth out this morning. Which probably isn't a bad thing for a politician. But the point is, by having a competitive, reasonable tax structure, you're going to keep the higher income people here, and we're actually going to get in recoveries higher tax revenues, which is what we all want. Okay? That's the idea behind the dynamic versus static bill, and why I believe that we should at least, where possible, have a dynamic analysis where if we would have known we'd lost $1 billion in Minnesota income when we passed a tax increase, maybe we wouldn't have made it quite as high, and we'd actually have higher tax revenues and a higher surplus today. With that, Madam Chair, I believe the Department of Revenue is here, and they'd like to make a few comments.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Welcome, Mr. Cummings. If you please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. So I was able to speak with Representative Grunhagen last night, and we're very thankful that he's open to continued conversation. Madam Chair, many times you see me in the Tax Committee representing the department or the administration on various tax policy items. But today I want to focus our attention on something else. I know that there is a thought or a need to talk about the dynamism in terms of the tax code. I want us to think about what are the ways in which, what tools do we use in order to score the state budget. So we need to make sure that we have tools that are accurate and consistent to estimate the impact of state revenue from various bills. So our research divisions, I think they do a very good job completing over 800 revenue estimates each biennium in a professional and transparent and timely way. And we would like that to continue. And I think, so I'm hoping that we can continue to think about if the tools that have been provided continue to provide the tax committee with the needed items in order to have a professional, transparent, timely, consistent, and accurate way of estimating the impact from various bills. Madam Chair, if this bill and other bills move through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you and Representative Grunhagen and staff. I do want to, I think in order to continue this conversation about how estimates are put together, what is dynamic scoring, how has it worked in other states, I'd like to ask our research directors to come up here and talk a little bit more about that.
Are they here today?
They are here today, Madam Chair.
Why don't you bring them to the table and have them speak to the issues?
Dr. Paul Wilson has been the Director of Research at the Minnesota Department of Revenue since 2005. He previously worked at the department as an analyst in the Minnesota House of Representatives as a fiscal analyst for the Tax Committee. Before that, he was a professor of economics at St. Olaf Carleton and Bethel College. Mr. Eric Ouellette has been Director of Property Tax Research since 2007. Before that, he worked for the League of Minnesota Cities since 1995. So I'm pleased to introduce them to the committee. And I know I work for the Commissioner's Office, Madam Chair, at the Department of Revenue. These people, they work in the Tax Research Divisions, which is separate and obviously nonpartisan.
Dr. Wilson, welcome. It's good to see you again. Mr. Ouellette, thank you. Your comments, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Ouellette, and I'm the Director of Property Tax Research at the Department of Revenue. A little more background on our preparation of revenue estimates. We produce the official revenue estimates for bills that are being heard in tax committee. We also produce confidential revenue estimates for legislators and the governor in the policy formation process. So as they're putting policies together, they work with us on a confidential basis to know what the potential impacts of their proposals are. These estimates quantify the direct change in state tax revenues from the change in the tax law, and we use wherever possible we use standardized models and assumptions so that we can provide consistent estimates over time and between different tax related proposals. We also have an open feedback loop through our work because we don't know everything about the impacts of proposals. So we often get feedback from authors, from legislative staff, from parties that are interested in the legislation. When they do give us information that we didn't have, then we revise our revenue estimates to reflect the new information. We do, in some instances, take behavioral impacts into account with our revenue estimates. We do that when it's a direct impact from a change in the tax law, not a regulatory change or a secondary effect. And if there's general agreement on the magnitude of the impact, which is based either on our experience here in Minnesota, the experience other states have had when they've pursued similar policies, or peer-reviewed empirical research. We can talk about some examples of that if you're interested. I'll turn it over to Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Paul Wilson, Director of Tax Research Division at the Department of Revenue. And I'm pleased to be here. I want to say just a word about, again, Representative Grunhagen did explain dynamic revenue estimating. I want to say a few more words about what dynamic revenue estimating is. As Eric said, we do take some behavioral impacts into account. So we take, for example, a cigarette tax cut. We do take into account, based on our past experience, how purchases of cigarettes will change in response to an increase in the price of cigarettes when we raise the tax. As a rule, we do not include secondary effects or so-called macroeconomic feedback effects. And that's what dynamic scoring is about, are those secondary or macroeconomic feedback effects. If you had a $100 million cut in business taxes, for example, or taxes on business income, then as Representative Grunhagen said, you'd expect that to make investment in Minnesota more profitable, So you'd expect to see an increased investment in Minnesota. That would mean more building supplies be purchased, so you get sales tax on the building supply purchases. There would be more employment opportunities. Wages might go up. That means more income for the workers, and as a result, some feedback on the income tax side. With more income, there's more consumption, and as a result, some additional purchases, spending, so more sales tax, more excise tax revenue. There'll be changes in prices. There'll be changes in rents and property values. And there will be changes also in location. The models usually will build in some assumption about with higher employment opportunities in migration from out of state in response to that. And again, that will mean not only more revenues, but also some additional expenditures on schools and on infrastructure. So that's the kind of feedback effect we're talking about that we do not do in our revenue estimates now, and that this bill would ask us to do.
Yes.
Eric Willett and I want to talk about several, just make several observations. There's a long history of dynamic revenue estimating in the state at the state level. And so we want to share some of what we know from the experience in other states with you today. The first thing we know is that dynamic revenue estimating is difficult and expensive to do. We do not have a model to do this work now. So we would need to obtain a model. Now, the early models on this were developed by first model in Massachusetts by Price Waterhouse. California put in a model called a computable general equilibrium model, which was developed by UC Berkeley. These models are very complicated. Those, like a consumer general equilibrium model, is usually estimated to cost between $200,000 and $400,000 to develop, and it needs development, state-specific development from people who really are experts in that field. There also are ongoing costs, obviously. There's another option, which is probably what most states do if they're starting into dynamic revenue estimating, which is to use a model such as that created by the Regional Economic Modeling Incorporated, which is called REMI. Now, REMI is something some of you may have heard of because Deed actually has an older, more limited version of the REMI models. The REMI model, again, is one that you need to purchase. It needs to be created with state-specific parameters in it, generally about $150,000 upfront cost, and we don't have someone trained to use that kind of model. It is something that needs intensive training because it is very easy to abuse or misuse these models as well. Staffing would obviously increase as well. Now, these models are complicated because they have to look at changes. They have to have all these different parameters. I mean, how is the change going to change investment in the state? How is it going to change wages? How is it going to change income? And when that changes, how is consumption going to change? And what will happen in all these different parameters? So there are a whole bunch of parameters that need to be set in these models. They have to be state-specific because states are very different in their estimates. They have to work with different taxes. So you can't just have one for income tax. It has to work for sales tax. That's for excise tax. That's for state tax. And so you're talking about very complicated models that are needed. So the first thing we make is just simply that we are not currently equipped to do this, and it would take quite a bit of effort to get ourselves and some time to get ourselves ready and equipped to do this kind of analysis.
Thank you. Not only are they difficult to do, these sorts of analyses would also take quite a bit of time to complete once we were staffed and up to speed. We appreciate the language in the amendment that says we would only conduct these as we were, to the extent feasible. But other states that have had experience with this have generally put some parameters around when we would do these, so it wouldn't just be at the discretion of nonpartisan staff. For example, a tax cut in excess of $100 million or when requested by the chair of a particular committee or something like that. So some guidance, if this were to move forward, some guidance for you about when we should decide to do this and some understanding about our limited ability to conduct more than a handful of them in a given legislative session, I think that's a conversation that we would need to flesh out a little bit more because we do anticipate from experience in other states that even if we had staff who were ready to use this model, when we produce revenue estimates, we sometimes have a day's notice when a bill shows up on a tax committee hearing schedule, and we can turn around a regular static revenue estimate. We're talking about weeks of effort to potentially produce one of these if it were for a complicated proposal. So it doesn't fit well into our normal operating procedures, and we would need a little bit more guidance on when we would conduct an analysis like this and how it would fit into the other work that we're expected to do. I also want to point out a couple of considerations. Paul mentioned a lot of the complexity that you would have to work into the model. My area of expertise is in the property tax, and there are some unique aspects of property tax that I think would add some additional wrinkles to the difficulty of working with a model like this. A lot of the property tax legislation that leads to economic activity are economic development projects. And one of the things we would have to grapple with is what is the assumption about how much activity would have taken place without the incentive? Because we'd have to compare what would happen in the current law to what would happen under the proposal. And because of with dynamic scoring, we would need to estimate how much additional economic activity a project would bring in. That's an area of expertise that would be difficult for us, and it would be a challenge. In addition, with the state level taxes, you can use a statewide model. With property tax incentives, the location matters because property taxes are local, so they're very different in one jurisdiction and another based on the level of taxation and the mix of the tax base and that sort of thing. So we'd probably have to have more than one model based on where economic impact would happen from a property tax incentive. Finally, there's both state and local revenues in property tax. We have a statewide property tax as well as local revenues, so there's both an impact on the state budget and on local budgets when you're talking about property taxes. And the dynamic of property taxes is such that depending on the nature of the proposal, some property tax bills cut property taxes without impacting other property types, but many property tax proposals merely shift taxes from one property type to another. So in the model, we would have to have both of those dynamics reflected, the tax reduction for the targeted property as well as the tax increases for the properties that are taking on the shift of burden. So those are some additional things that the model would have to take into account if we were looking at property tax incentives.
As I said, there's a long history of dynamic revenue estimating at the state level. So I want to share a couple of some of the results in other states when they have used these models. Most of these models, I'm going to talk about a few states because there are a few states that have sort of done general comparisons of tax changes, usually tax cuts, for a particular tax type and look at the feedback effects. So for the income tax, for example, I mean, I guess I should start by saying I'm sure most of you are familiar, if not all of you, with the Laffer curve, which suggests that beyond a certain point, tax rates cut so high that you actually lose revenue when you raise tax rates, and that tax cuts can pay for themselves. So the idea here is how large are these feedback effects? What have other states found when they've done this work? For the income tax, in California, the feedback effect was estimated in 2000 on their computable general equilibrium model to be about 4% feedback. In Massachusetts in 1993, they were the first state to do this, and they discontinued it soon after, 6.4%. Nebraska has a dynamic model, it got 6.4% feedback. And in Oregon in 2001, they had 9.7% feedback rate. So somewhere between 4% and 10% is what other states have been finding for the feedback effects for income tax on income taxes. What this means is if you have a $100 million tax cut, income tax cut, sort of across the board tax cut on income taxes, the cost of that would actually be something more like $90 to $96 million rather than $100 million. So they find an effect, but that's a fairly modest effect, particularly because it takes time for these effects to show up. Sometimes you'll get an effect immediately. I mean, a gas tax example is a good one where you've got sort of an immediate impact. If you change some taxes, it takes time. It takes time for businesses to create new jobs, for example. So in these models, it's generally show that full adjustment to the new situation takes 5 to 6 years. And so you're talking about a change in revenue 5 to 6 years from now of that amount and in between smaller amounts. So again, I think it's important just to note that the experience of those states has been surprising to the proponents of dynamic revenue estimating, who expected much larger impacts from these models than they were getting. For sales tax, Massachusetts showed a 4.9% rate. California showed 12%, and Nebraska showed 20%. It's intriguing to me that the sales tax feedback effect was about three times as large as the income tax effect in the estimates in California and in Nebraska. Corp tax, you have higher estimates, but they were all done before we went single sales apportionment. In the corporate tax, it makes a big difference how you apportion a multi-state company's income. We've moved to 100% sales apportion, which means where payroll is and where property is doesn't make any difference for your corporate tax. This reduces the competitive disadvantage that a corporate tax imposes. It would tremendously change or reduce the impact of a change in the corporate tax on a lot of the things that these models would pick up. We actually tried to get the REMI model to model. REMI model, back when we did a study of angel investment credit a couple years ago, tried to use the REMI model to estimate the impact of a change in corporate tax, which was mandated when that study was mandated. We were required to do this, and we basically threw up our hands because REMI is not equipped to deal with a 100% sales apportioned corporate tax. So, again, the models are tough to work with. I would say that when you look at broader tax reforms, often you get a 1% to 2% feedback effect. So I guess the point is that the impacts are much more moderate than sometimes people would believe they would be. And again, this is experience from a lot of different states with a lot of different people doing the modeling. So I would caution against believing that you're going to get large impacts. And given the timing delay, you're not likely to see much of this impact within the budget window. So for budgeting purposes, it makes a big difference that it's delayed as well as being fairly moderate in its impact.
Okay. Well, folks, here's what we're going to do. We've got members that have questions. We are going to start the Lunan bill at 9 o'clock, and then we are going to be ending committee early today at 9:30. I have a list of members' questions. I've got Representative Schultz here first up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So those were those realized effects, or were those effects that the model predicted?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, these are predictions of the models. It's very hard to see the actual impacts of a dynamic revenue estimating because they're spread among a whole bunch of taxes. So you could look at what happens to tax revenue in the state as a whole, but it's very hard to track. So I don't know of any examples where we really have tested results of what the actual results were compared to those. But that's what the models are predicting based upon the parameters in the model.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what happened in Kansas when they reduced their state income tax? Did they have a model that predicted this a beneficial impact when they realized a decline of over $800 million in 1 year?
Dr. Schultz.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I'm not as familiar with Kansas as I probably should be. I know they had a group come in with a dynamic model created by, it was called the STAMP model. It showed about a 13% interaction, I think. The STAMP model shows larger impacts than most other models do. But that was not, as far as I know, that was not used in official budgeting or in the revenue amount. For budgeting purposes, it was not used, but it was used in the case being made for the tax cuts, but I don't think it was used. And I don't think any state has ever used dynamic revenue estimates in the budget process itself to actually price or score for budget purposes.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I would be concerned about the confidence interval and the level of ability to predict accurately in these complex models. And I think they're very dependent on what assumptions you use that you put into the model. And having to change the model quarterly or annually doesn't seem like it would be a good investment of our money, state money, for these models. So I'm not supportive of doing dynamic modeling for Minnesota for budgeting.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this seems to be, if I get this right, it's a very complicated mathematical analysis of secondary effects of instituted policy. Is that true? Something like that?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then one question I had then, I agreed with the governor when he raised income taxes on the wealthiest to invest in early childhood and higher education and nursing homes and the like. Would dynamic analysis measure those things, or is it because of the time frame at which you see the positive benefits is so long you don't see it? How does that work in dynamic analysis?
Dr. Wilson.
I'm sure Representative Johnson, you're asking about what the money was spent for. Is that not the actual tax?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we estimate the impact of the taxes themselves, and we don't. Neither of us does any work on the expenditure side in terms of those kinds of policies. So I think that question would have to be addressed to others. I mean, obviously things take time. Early childhood, the impact of early childhood education obviously is going to take quite a bit of time to show up in the economic impacts. But I don't have any particular knowledge about that, the timing of that or the amount of that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I take a look at the dynamic analysis, this is already going on in the private sector, I believe, in banking and risk analysis and insurance. And I would say they pretty much got it down to a point where it concerns regulators that there isn't a sharing of the risk. So this is already out there. I don't think this has to be something that starts at square one. I also see where this could dramatically change how legislators make decisions about funding for programs, not just tax movements, but also I sit on the development committee with Representative Johnson, and entities come forward with all of these powerful ideas, and it's exciting, and there's a contention that we spend a dollar here, we're going to get a payback on that dollar from tax revenue. And as a business person, I'm actually surprised that there's no mechanism here right now that captures that future revenue that's created and allows that program to benefit from its success and funds itself, so we can, from the general fund, actually step away from it and the taxes that it creates from some of these business developments and things like that, which I have seen work. Why we just don't plow that back into the successful program so that we're fostering and fertilizing the strongest plant. So I see a benefit to this, and I don't think my question would be, is there an opportunity or a way that we can go to the private sector that's already done this? There's so much big data out there. There's so many algorithms that are out there that we can somehow utilize some of that. Would that be a cost-effective move?
Dr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, Representative, obviously the people that do the economic forecast in Minnesota use state-of-the-art and do bring into account all these kinds of things. In terms of the Economic Development Committee, though, that what's done there, I know that Deed does have their REMI model, and so they do have a model that does do this kind of work, but it's not a tax model, and so the model they have does not estimate the tax impacts. And when that's been done before, we've been concerned with the way it was done, but this is many years ago when they did bring in the tax side. Obviously you can find all kinds of people who can give you answers, who can give you predictions of what the business is going to do. The question is, what are they based upon? We would have to use the assumptions. I mean, I don't think we would just say we'll take what, I mean, you wouldn't in that committee say we'll take whatever you suggest. So I'm not quite sure what models are out there that you're talking about that are sort of generally agreed upon to be the correct models to estimate these things. But we'd certainly be willing to hear from you about that.
Representative Lunan.
And just as a follow-up to that, it would seem, and in the business sector they do this, that over time, maybe over a short period of time, they start discerning what is valid data and what is data that is not pertinent, that is ancillary to whatever we're talking about, so that there could be a refinement that goes on, which would kind of speak to the constant updates. I come from the insurance industry, and boy, they're all about that, and just tying down the data tighter and tighter to do accurate prediction of through all aspects of it, all aspects of the risk experience what the behavior is going to be and what that dollar amount would be. So I think in the development committee, the tax consequences, if they're asking for an appropriation and it's going to generate some revenue, this is just my opinion, it seems like that circle should be closed, and the revenue that it does cause by its success would go right back into that program and it would become self-sufficient. I think that would be the ultimate goal.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And good morning. Fun to see the tax guys here. I just have a couple questions. Do you do any look backs to see how accurate your predictions are? And you mentioned, Dr. Wilson, the cigarette tax. So if I'm recalling, that was going to generate about $344 million in new taxes. And how did we do on that, Dr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, Representative, we like to talk about the cigarette tax estimates. We do very well on them. So we came within, came extremely close 2 times ago, and last time we actually came in, we were a little low on our estimate. It raised a little bit more than we expected. But that's one where, again, you can see the numbers very clearly. It doesn't really depend upon a forecast. There may have been some impact. Some people have said that the reason we came in high was because gas prices went down and people spent more money on cigarettes when they went to the gas station. So those kind of things can always have an impact. Look back for others are tougher. There are a few times when we make an estimate and it's clear. I do not want to talk about the gambling taxes for the stadium. Okay, but so sometimes errors are very clear. but the on things like income tax, I mean, we can look at, for example, the fourth tier income tax increase, what we predicted at the time and what has actually come in. We know what the extra 2% actually at the top is raised. We came in 10 to 12% low on that estimate, despite the fact that it was a static estimate. If we'd had a dynamic revenue adjustment, we would have taken that estimate down and would have been even more wrong than we were. So that money came in higher. Now, I'm assuming that's mostly because of the forecast, that the economy grew faster than it was expected to grow at the time we made the estimate. So it's very hard to do a look back because, you know, we like to blame the forecast if we're off. and in some cases, that really is the case. So we don't have a lot of cases where we can do look back pretty easily, but there are some. If we do a change in sales tax, we change the base. We can't track what we actually lost from a no exemption because we don't, you know, the way the sales tax is collected, we can't track that directly in any way. So most taxes, we have a really hard time tracking whether we were right or wrong. But income tax credit, we can do that because we have the data.
And Madam Chair, just one other one. Does your ability to anticipate and project, do you use that internally as the department is looking at new regulations? I mean, the bill is about regulations as well. And I'm just thinking of what appears to be the DOR taking a much harder line on residency rules, and to what extent do you think and so on is that going to have a chilling effect on folks who reside in Minnesota? Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair and Representative, we do not work on the compliance estimates directly. The compliance-related estimates, which is really the work that's been done on that, are done by others in the department, but we've not done anything on that.
Okay. We're going to pause here a moment. I do have Representative Nelson, Carlson, and Petersburg, and then we are going to go to Representative Lunan's bill. Mr. Cummings.
Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck, in terms of residency, the rules and the way that we've administered it has not changed for decades. Now, in 2014, we had received some comments from members of the Tax Committee and others about residency. So we really did do an extensive look related to residency, and we issued a report. One of the things within the report is that we talked both about the existing rule, and we also talked about the way in which we work with taxpayers. So I know throughout this past interim, in 2014, we met with the Minnesota Society of CPAs, we met with the bankers, we met with the lawyers, we met with the chamber, we met with others to really talk about residency in Minnesota. So on the one hand, we have done extensive training from anyone who may encounter a taxpayer dealing with a residency question. So that could be anyone on a phone line, that could be an auditor, that could be a person working in income tax or corporate tax, in order to make sure that we're treating them in a consistent way. We have changed our questionnaire, Madam Chair, so that it is shorter, so many of the types of things that we're asking for maybe we're not asking right now. We also looked at the way in which the rule could be construed in a modern world. You know, it talks about where a bank location is, and we're really talking about where you go to, what ATM you're taking it out of, rather than what is the address at the bottom of the bank. Now, there was not a tax bill that we did also issue a revenue notice to try and ensure that whether it's banking or whether it's CPAs, that we were not looking by itself at those factors related to residency. But we are open, Madam Chair. There was not a tax bill that passed last year. We are continuing to work with Chair Davids on some other changes to residency that ensures that both that we're having a fair system for all, including those that may have encountered the residency. So we have taken a hard look at that, Representative Runbeck.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess Dr. Ouellette and or Dr. Paulson and Mr. Ouellette, what I'm hearing here, and this is just, we'll break it down to what I'm hearing, that if we do this, it's going to cost the state more to do it, because we're going to have to buy a program or develop a program. We're going to have to hire people to train on this program so they're putting the right data in. It sounds like the old thing about computers, garbage in, garbage out. So if the person putting the information in this new program puts the wrong information in or reads it wrong, it's going to be bad data. It's going to take more time to do this so that if we're in the middle of session and we want a tax revenue estimate on a bill that was before us, we're not going to get it because it's going to take longer than the current system does, and it's not going to be as predictable. This kind of sounds like something government does all the time. I don't know why we're even debating this bill. It sounds like a perfect bill to pass. All kidding aside, sounds like we're, you know, the other thing I'm getting out of this, it sounds like you're listening to the evening news and you're listening to the weathermen. And the weathermen today all talk about they got all these models that they predict the weather and how this is going to happen, and each model predicts something different, and that snow that we're going to get or the rain we're going to get is may or may not come out. And I think back to Bud Crayling many, many years ago when I was a little kid that would predict the weather, and he seemed to have, you know, he'd call Sioux Falls and he'd call Fargo and see what the weather is there, and then he'd make a prediction based on that. And he was actually more accurate than some of the current weather predictors are today making their predictions. So this, I guess, it's going to cost more, it's going to take more time, and it's not going to be predictable, and we're not going to get the information we need to make the decisions. I don't know why we'd want to go this direction.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, actually somewhat related to Representative Nelson's concerns, my question, first of all, what is the motion before us? To lay the bill over and for possible inclusion? This bill here seems to me to be ripe for a fiscal note. And I think, Madam Chair, if the decision is made that the bill move forward after it's laid over, a fiscal note should be requested by either you or the author. I'm sure it would be requested when the bill would be referred to Ways and Means. So the questions that we have are the information we got from the testimony that it's going to take purchase of additional software, it's going to take training, and as I listened to the discussion, I was just wondering if it could be done with current staff level. I don't need to have you answer that question now. That would all appear in a fiscal note for the department. So Madam Chair, I would request that perhaps that information be provided with for us if the bill were to move forward.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Wilson, for being here. I appreciate your expertise in this area, and I certainly am one of those that understands the difficulty in trying to predict revenue sources. As a church administrator, I have the undaunting task of trying to predict offering on those that we can't even charge on a $2 million budget. So I do understand that on income side it's important. My simple question to you is that this bill, I believe, refers to all fiscal notes, and so my question to you is, in your opinion, do you think a dynamic version of fiscal note may have some value in the expense side or the spending side of our fiscal notes?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg, again, I think that's something that is best spoken to by MMB, but clearly on the expenditure side, there are similar dynamic impacts. I have no idea, but if you obviously we're talking about additional tax revenues because of gas prices going down. Mm-hmm. Any program that gives people more money would have some kind of impact. You've got regulations, you've got other things. I mean, so the expenditure side, I just don't know anything about how that would be done. But I think that's a question for the other departments or for MMB.
Dr. Wilson, talking about the cigarette tax again, so you guys had your prediction model for that on the revenue that would be brought in. Would the smuggling be a secondary result of that wasn't included in your estimate that you had before, or was that something that you included? I can't remember, but certainly that was a concern that many of us have, and now we're seeing the results of that.
Madam Chair, the model we use, despite that, we do use an elasticity, but we don't actually, for revenue spending purposes, we don't actually have to break down how much is due to actual reduction in smoking and how much is due to purchase of cigarettes elsewhere, and certainly smuggling would fit in there too. So we're looking at, based on past experience, what happens in response to what happens to our tax packs in response to a change in price. And so we did not, our revenue spending does not break those pieces into pieces, but it's in there as an estimate, as part of the estimate, obviously.
And Mr. Cummings, can you tell me what was the agency's request for cigarette smuggling abatement? Can you tell me what that request is? I can't remember it off the top of my head.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the request was, it was a request that dealt primarily with tobacco smuggling. I know that the what we have with cigarettes is we actually have a stamp that goes on, and so the stamp is easily verifiable, but as we're relating to other tobacco products, we don't have the same type of stamps that we have with cigarettes. So in terms of the smuggling that we're seeing, it wouldn't be, I don't think the best characterization is to say that is a cigarette issue. It's a tobacco issue, and a lot of times that we see it with other tobacco products.
And Mr. Cummings, how much was the request from the department?
Madam Chair, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it was about $1 million or $900,000 in terms of the request from the department. And then there was also some compliance revenue as it relates to that. But the compliance revenue would have been, I think, in the area of $2 million, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. I know that was a conversation that we had in the tax committee, and it happened right after the increases. Representative Grunhagen, you have the final word.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for vetting this bill. Couple follow-up
briefly,
comments.
Please, Mr. Grunhagen, Representative Grunhagen.
Okay. I did order a fiscal analysis that has been ordered. It isn't here yet. Second thing is, we live in a dynamic global economy. Okay, the world is changing. Our children are going to have to compete not only within our state and nation, they're going to have to compete globally. I give you the example of New York. They're cutting taxes, okay, for their businesses because they want to grow the private sector. You know, if you look at the Laffer curve, you look at, and I never thought I'd use this, price elasticity. I learned that in Economics 101. I don't know why I remember it because I didn't think it was important. But, you know, taxes raise the price of something. You become less competitive. Businesses are going to make the decision with modern technology to go where they have to go to have a reasonable tax rate. Look at Medtronic, founded in Minnesota. Now their headquarters is moved to Ireland. All right, the CEO was quoted that over $4 billion in tax savings, approximate, by making that move. We have to. Let's put it this way: static is in the past. It's a fossilized dinosaur in a dynamic global economy. Dynamic is the future. I, as a businessman, I own my own business. There's times where I have to spend money to be more efficient and effective and ultimately make more money. Again, the bill doesn't mandate this, okay? It makes it optional. I would be open to the department coming with an amendment, putting parameters on it, whether a chair requested it or it had to have a certain minimum amount before the analysis is done. But if we look at the private sector, they use the dynamic model across their country, and they don't use the static model. If they did, most of them would be out of business, okay, or miss opportunities. So again, I gave you two examples right in front of you that within just a year or two, it had a great impact on what our revenues are. And I'll close with this, is we all want higher tax revenues. The question is, how do we get there? And one of the ways we get there is having a competitive tax and regulatory system, which if you emphasize static, you're not going to get there, in my opinion, and you're not equipping us with the tools we need to make decisions as we go forward in a global economy. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. With that, members, I renew my motion to lay over House File 2971 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Lunan. Welcome.
Thank you. You probably won't hear me say this very often, but I will be brief. I move that we take House File 3001 for possible layover for inclusion.
Actually, I think that we'll send this to Ways and Means.
All right. Goes to Ways and Means Committee. Okay. I stand corrected.
Why did the other one go
ahead? Regarding this bill. What this bill is about, members, is it's transparency. There's three components to it. The first component has to do with required notifications to the legislative auditor. If there is belief that there is a potential federal fine dealing with bond sales or purchases. The second provision has to do with the department incurring the responsibility for the fine and having that funded out of their operating budget to take care of it there. And the third provision has to do with notifying the legislative auditor and all leadership once the fine is paid. The intent of this bill is to create transparency and to tighten up the communication between the department and the legislative body.
Okay. And is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Welcome. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. Chair. My name is John Pollard. I'm the Legislative Director for Minnesota Management and Budget. I, too, hopefully can help you move quickly today. Minnesota Management and Budget is supportive of the concept of the bill. MMB has created internal policies for disclosing these issues in the future, and if the legislature were to choose to put those in statutes, we would be supportive. Representative Lunan was kind enough to host us last week for a meeting to discuss the bill before you. After reviewing the legislation, we did have some concerns about various pieces of legislation. For example, the way we read the bill, the commissioner would have broad discretion on what he believes would be subject to, what could subject the state to a possible penalty, and we would like to tighten that up a little bit. We sent Representative Lunan some suggested alternative language yesterday afternoon. We based that suggested language on existing statutes that require notification to the legislature. The thing that they have in common is a clear triggering event that would require that notification. We are supportive of disclosing to the legislative auditor, as we are required to disclose to the OLA several other things throughout the year. They understand our practices, and they also understand the privacy laws surrounding the issues that we deal with. We are also supportive of the communication to the chairs outlined in the bill. I can answer any questions if you have any.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
This doesn't specifically relate to this bill, but why is this bill going to Ways and Means when the previous bill didn't go to Ways and Means?
Because that's the option that we wanted to do, and that doesn't mean that this bill might not be included in the omnibus bill, but I just thought it would be helpful for this to move on its own.
Well, I guess, why isn't it helpful for the other bill to also be looked at by Ways and Means. It seems it's a Ways and Means issue also.
Well, we're going to be looking at all of this legislation at some point, again, at some point, so.
I'm just interested in the different motions.
Sure. Any other questions? Representative Earhart, did you have a question, or were you just commenting?
Oh, I was just thinking, once is enough to look at these bills, Madam Chair.
Members? Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a follow-up to Representative Kahn's question and going back to my comments on the previous bill about a fiscal note. I assume then if you include the previous bill and would include this one as well, even though it you said it could be dual-tracked, I guess, with your final comments there, that the omnibus bill that you've kind of implied with referring these bills for possible inclusion then would go to Ways and Means. The understanding that I had as chair and Representative Knobloch has as chair, anything that has a fiscal impact of more than $3,000 has to go to Ways and Means. Mm-hmm. So I assume that would be the tracking then?
Well, it's not an assumption that this would cost more than $3,000, but I think that because of the conversation that we had in Ways and Means regarding this issue, I thought it would be helpful for it to go there. I suspected that that would be your desire, Representative Carlson, having been a former chair of the Ways and Means. Well, also, with this issue, I don't anticipate that this is going to cost the agency any money because, as Mr. Pollard pointed out, this is something that they're intending to do in an informal basis. This is just to codify it.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm talking about the previous bill, and that would be a driver, and I don't know what the cost of this one may or may not be, but I mean, I concur that it should go to Ways and Means because of the issue's history, but I guess I'm asking, as Representative Kahn did, if you put together an omnibus bill that has some costs in it, it has to go to Ways and Means, whether this one is included or not. Well, the previous bill obviously would drive it there.
The bill goes to Ways and Means.
Pardon?
So every omnibus, a state government finance bill goes to Ways and Means. So,
well, that's what I'm asking, what your plans are. Theoretically, wouldn't have to if you had it only policy, but if it's got any fiscal impact, it
has. If there's any fiscal impact to the state government omnibus bill, it will be going to Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loon. Thank you, Mr. Pollard. Members, with that, we are, oh, that's right. That's so used to. Sorry. All those in favor of Representative Loon's renewed motion on House File 3001 to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you.
It is adopted. Oh, it's been a long time since I've done that. All right. We are adjourned, folks. Thank you.